Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Lenworth was back on the main road to Anchovy proper. Past Long Hill's deep ravines and its corners and its peak, and long past the canopy of trees that shaded the steep road snaking up from the coast. He was on foot this time with the baby in the crook of one arm and an oversized bag that he pulled with the other hand. Having mistaken one house on a hill for the one he sought, he was lost, and the driver who had taken him there had already left. On that stretch of road without the towering trees, the sun's heat was like a glove on his body, too close, too heavy, and the sweat dribbling along his spine and in every crevice, more of an annoyance than a cooling mechanism. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm talking to Donna Hemans, author of Tea by the Sea, a gut-wrenching story about a young woman who experiences the unspeakable fear of all new mothers. Her baby disappears from the hospital after she gives birth. The evil deed is perpetrated by the baby's father, who, in his distorted thinking, figures that he's doing a good deed, because this way, 17-year-old Plum will be able to live her life unencumbered by having to raise a child. Lanworth, the father, is able to convince himself again and again that his self-absorbed responses to adversity are really for the good of others. And he keeps it up for 17 years because Lanworth is always able to wriggle out of difficult situations. Hi, Donna. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Galit. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have just released this beautiful novel, your second novel, in the middle of a global pandemic. How is that working?
It's certainly not at all what I expected. And I mean, I've spoken to so many other writers and it's a work in progress. I think one of the things that I am happy that has happened, though, is I have found communities of writers who are all in the same position. Mm-hmm. And we are sharing advice. You know, people are talking about what they're doing. And so I think we have all been able to build on and borrow from what other people are doing. But it is indeed a weird time. It's not something that I imagine we'll ever have to go through again.
Let's hope. So how did you come to write Tea by the Sea?
Well, I think of it as a three-part process. One, I had an idea to write a story about a group of people who went to a church and refused to leave. But at that point, I had no idea why they were there and what would actually make them leave. And so the second part of it was sometime after that, I started writing a short section about a mother who was getting her daughters ready for school. And she, went through a whole litany of things, got them ready, dropped them off at school, and started down the subway in Brooklyn. But instead of actually getting onto the train, she turned around and went to the church. And so at that point, I then knew who was in the church, but I didn't know why she was there. And again, what would make her decide to leave? So sometime after that, I was in Jamaica, as you know, with my parents, and we were playing Scrabble one night, a Sunday evening. And there's a program that comes on the radio every Sunday, and it's called Sunday Contact. And basically, people just call in to look for others that they have lost touch with. And on that particular evening, a woman called in, and she was looking for her son, who was about 8 years old. And what she knew was that the child's father had taken the boy, but she didn't know where they were. If they were in Jamaica, if they had migrated, she just had no clue where to find her child. And once I heard that, I said, this is my story. This is why this mother is in that church and why she's refusing to leave.
Wow. So the story opens with the father carrying his day-old baby girl filled with ideas of how he's going to devote himself to raising her. And we don't know yet that he's kidnapped his child, but he immediately starts lying. So we know he's not what he seems.
Right.
But he seems so devoted. He's smart. He's well-educated. Where did this terrible part of him come from?
Well, I think he believes he's doing something good. And I think one of the things that we learn later on in the book, and I don't want to give away too much, but one of the things that we learn is that he thought he was giving the mother of the child, Plum, a chance to have a decent life, to have a life without being burdened by a baby at such a young age. And one of the things that we'll find out is that Lenworth grew up with a mother and a sister who had children, but were raising children without the father in the picture. And he had grown accustomed to seeing his mother and sister struggle, and he did not want Plum to go through the same kind of struggle. So he thinks he's doing something good. As readers, we might have a certainly different idea of whether it was good or not.
Right. And the part where he has to lie every turn might have given him a clue that he wasn't as altruistic as he thought, but he didn't catch that. So Plum is a beautiful, wild teenager. Could you talk about how her parents decide to send her back to boarding school?
You know, it's one of the things that I think almost every person from the Caribbean and probably from other groups or the immigrant groups have heard growing up is that, you know, parents, at least in Jamaica, at least in the Caribbean culture, is one thing where parents will say that they are sending their children back to wherever they have come from so that they will learn and become a better person. And so in Plum's case, I think she got into her cousin got into a little bit of trouble, and her parents decided that she, you know, the influences that around her were not the right ones. So they wanted her in a different place, in a different environment where she would not necessarily get into trouble. She found a whole different sort of trouble once she got to Jamaica. But again, her parents wanted something different for her, wanted to take her away from what they considered to be bad influences in Brooklyn.
Well, since you brought it up, so you grew up in Jamaica. So can you talk a little bit about how your education there affected you, how much of your whole, and then you came to college in this country. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One thing that I think people will, or people who know Jamaica or people who know me, might recognize a little bit of the school there. The high school I went to in Jamaica is called Westwood High School. I was a day student at a boarding school. And so I borrowed a little bit from that school and another boarding school to build the school that Plum attends in Jamaica. And I went to school in Jamaica. I finished high school there and then moved to New York, went to college in Brooklyn. So my experience is certainly different from Plum's experience in the book, but I think I was able to borrow from living in Jamaica, living in Brooklyn, borrowing from my two experiences in order to create the experience she had.
Mm-hmm. Why do her parents refuse to live in Jamaica, even though they love it there?
It's one of those things where there's so much that you get accustomed to when you live somewhere else that, you know, you go back to Jamaica and you go back to Jamaica now, and certainly I do too. And there's some things that you see that are just so very different. There are some things that you're accustomed to, some things that you would like to see that are just handled differently in Jamaica. For example, if you go to the bank to try to get any business done, the amount of paperwork that you have to go through is just so daunting. But whereas some of the things that you would be able to do here very quickly and very easily just requires mounds and mounds of actual physical paper in Jamaica. So some of it is just simply is, you know, those kinds of differences. Mm-hmm. You get used to a certain lifestyle and you want to have the same thing in Jamaica, but you might not necessarily have it. But at the same time, there is also so much about being in Jamaica that you miss. The weather, for one, the fruits that you, you know, have grown up eating, the food in itself in general, your family, your friends, you want to have that, but you also want to have some of the other conveniences that, you know, you had in your new life or your other life.
Yeah. Let's talk about the food. I had to take several breaks to get a snack because there was a lot mentioned. Let's talk about it. What did you love?
You know, I don't remember much of the food that I talked about. I know tea, definitely. That's one thing that I talked about and wrote about in the book. One, because of the title, but also it's something that Plum loves. And she makes a habit out of taking like dried peel or anything, you know, fruit, pieces of fruit that you would discard and using that to make tea. And, you know, I think it's something that so many people or so many cultures do, where we have a lot of other teas that, you know, a lot of other teas that are beneficial or that we're told is beneficial. And I think I wanted to build and bring some of that into the story.
And she carries around a tin, right?
Right. She had... yeah, she made her own tea and she sat with Lenworth at lunch, you know, like, and they had tea. And most of the times he was able to bring tea because she was in boarding, so she didn't necessarily have access to it, whereas he did. But she was able to talk to him and tell him about some of the other things that he could use to make Vera's tea.
Mm-hmm. So Lenworth sets up a home in Anchovy, which is about 7 miles outside of Montego Bay in Jamaica. How does he know that no one will look for him there, including his immediate family members and especially Plum?
Well, Plum, I think, one of the things that Lenworth had done throughout his entire life with Plum was tell various stories about himself. And so when she met him, she understood that he was from a completely different part of Jamaica called Greenwood. But he had spent some time in Greenwood, but not necessarily a significant portion of his life. And Anchovy, turns out, was just there was a house there that belonged to his father, but a house that he knew of, but his mother didn't necessarily know about. And without knowing Lenworth's mother, Plum would not figure out where else to look for him. And even when she met Lenworth's mother, his mother didn't have any idea where he was gone.
Mm-hmm. Who is Mrs. Murray and why is she so kind to Plum?
Well, Mrs. Murray is the landlady who Plum returns to. Plum and Lenworth had been renting a house on Mrs. Murray's property. And when Plum leaves the hospital and finds out that Lenworth has completely disappeared, she, you know, is pretty much left without any family members to support her or to take care of her. And Mrs. Murray steps in. You know, I want to think that there are many people in the world like that who just simply out of the goodness and kindness of within themselves, that they would help a woman like Plum, somebody in Plum's situation where she had no immediate family members to help her out.
But Lenworth also finds a kind woman, Sister Ivy, to help him, not because of him, but because of the baby. In fact, most of your characters are good-hearted people. Only Lenworth is evil, but even he has a good side. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think what works in Lenworth's favor is that he returns to Anchovy where his family had been living for a long time. So he's able to use the good name of his family to his benefit. And so the older woman he meets there in Anchovy just responds to him partly because he has this newborn baby that he's caring for. The story he tells her is that the child's mother died in childbirth. And I think he would, almost anybody I imagine, would get sympathy for being in that kind of a situation.
I think sorry, go ahead.
No, he is just able to use the situation that he puts himself into to get the kind of attention that he needs.
Yeah. There's kind of a theme of really extraordinarily kind women, except for Plum's husband, Alan. Are there any kind men?
You know, that's a good question. I think her father was relatively kind. He, you know, her parents certainly sent her back to Jamaica, and I think that they wanted to do something good for her. And I believe, you know, the way I look at it, when she comes back to Brooklyn, they again try to make, try to get her back on track, get her on the right track. So I look at her father as a good person or a good man. And, you know, I guess I also want to say, I don't necessarily set out to write bad men. It just simply happens that in this particular story, Lenworth just does something that turns out to be not as good as he initially thought it was going to be.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking that most men are kind of ugh. So I'm just kidding. Sister Ivy actually helps make Lenworth become a better person. Can you talk about that?
That she does. And I wanted her to, well, I wanted Lenworth to not, I think as writers, we have to be careful to, you know, certainly make sure that we're writing people who are multidimensional and they're not just all bad or all good. So one of the things that I certainly wanted to have Lenworth become or to be is to grow into himself. To not only recognize some of his failures, but also try to become a better person. And he tries to be a good father to Opal. He gets married and he tries in his way to be a good wife and a good father to the two boys he has. He doesn't necessarily, he fails at a lot of it, as we all do. But I think he tries. And much of that is due to Sister Ivy, who does set out to help him find his way in Anchovy and become the person that he becomes.
He's really quite an interesting character. So he goes along. Sister Ivy wants the baby to be christened, and Lenworth couldn't care less about religion or church, which makes it even stranger when he later decides to become a priest. Okay, so I really have to take a step back here. I have a sister-in-law and a brother-in-law who are both Episcopal priests separately. And right. They, each of them were called, they have explained how they were called to becoming priests, and they're infused, each of them infused with spirituality. So how is someone like Lenworth able to become a priest, even if he does it as an escape?
You know, I think that I have met a good number of people who turn to the church or turn to become pastors in some form or the other, whose life doesn't necessarily reflect their spirituality or their beliefs. And so I wanted to draw from that experience in creating Lenworth. But in addition to that, I think Lenworth wanted to become an engineer. He wanted to build buildings. He wanted to build big things. And he looks at Christianity or looks at religion, looks at the priesthood as building in a different way. And so that's the reason he really becomes a priest or goes off to, you know, study to become a priest. So I think that is part of it. The other part, too, is that one of the things that I learned a long time ago was that the Episcopal Church, at least in Jamaica, and we call it the Anglican Church there, they require their priests to teach for a few years before they enter, before they start studying. And so having taught, Lenworth was in a good position to use that to then study, you know, enter the seminary and study to become a priest. So it worked out to his advantage.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how Plum decides what profession to follow. I loved that story.
Yeah, hers was just very different. Her mother had worked in the healthcare setting, and she did not want to, didn't initially want to be in healthcare at all. And this, all of this happened when she returned to Brooklyn and had to figure out what to do with her life while still trying to figure out where her child and Lenworth had gone. And she, you know, goes to the Brooklyn Public Library and starts looking through some books and picks something that seems to work for her. She becomes a lab tech. It's, you know, like a, not necessarily something that I think most of us would think about initially, but, you know, my sister is a lab tech, and so I was able to draw from her experiences as a lab tech to help to round out some of the things that Plum would be doing as a lab tech.
I like how she just sat at the library looking through professions.
Right.
That was so cute. Let's talk about your title, Tea by the Sea.
That one, I had, I read it somewhere or I saw it somewhere and I wrote it down. And strangely enough, I just knew it would make a great title for a book. And I left it alone. And when I started writing this book, I said, you know, that would be a good title. And then I had to, once I started working on the book, and I realized how the title itself fit into the story. I like to write about the water and just about everything, almost everything that I write, there is some body of water involved in it. And I knew that Plum would be spending a good amount of time at the beach. Drinking tea was also a big thing for her. So it just made sense that that would be the title of this book. Once, you know, like Opal got a little bit older, I had to figure out exactly how it would play into her life. And one of the things that readers will learn is that her father, Lenworth, uses Tea by the Sea as a way to bridge, as a way to give Opal some kind of a relationship with her mother that is completely non-existent because of what he did the day Opal was born.
Mm-hmm. It takes Plum many years to be willing to marry Alan. Does she love him?
That's a good question. I think she does on some level, but I think that she had to make a decision to move forward with her life. She had been disappointed over and over. She had been searching for Opal. She got to Jamaica, thought she had a really good lead, got to the house in Anchovy and found it empty, and came back to New York with an idea that she would stop searching. But she also, at that point, had to make a decision where she would go with her life, how she would move forward with her life. And it just made sense in some ways to create something else to replace the child she didn't think she would be finding, and in some ways to replace Lenward. So I think there is some love there, but at that moment when she makes that decision, it's certainly not about love. It's simply about having somebody in your life and not really being alone, having something to replace what you have already lost.
Yeah. Well, it's just a lovely book, and so many emotional highs and lows. Happy, sad, up,
right.
Down. Oh, so a little bit of nail biting, but it's a lovely book. What are you working
Thank
on
you.
Next?
Well, I have two other novels that I had started writing before I wrote Tea by the Sea. And I have revised at least one. Another one I need to work on the revisions for. And so the one that I think at this moment, I still believe it's done, is a story about a family's migratory patterns through the Caribbean and in America. So they had spent some time in Cuba, and one daughter in the story also lived in America. So I wanted to do something that just really traced how Caribbean people have moved around, both within the Caribbean and outside.
Sign me up. It really sounds interesting. There's a lot more need for more immigrant stories because this is a country based on immigrants. And
certainly.
There's some issues with immigrant rights right now.
Right.
As actually quite this very week.
Yeah, but, quite a bit of it, right?
Right.
And there are lots of stories. There are lots of stories that we don't necessarily hear either.
Yeah, and we all have from different parts of the world. I mean, my parents were barely born here, but I'm second generation because of that. You know, very few of us have long histories here. Although
right.
Some do. Donna, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been just lovely. And I wish you the best of luck with this book and the other books.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host of New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Donna Hemans, author of Tea by the Sea. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Book Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As New Book Network listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.